a member there. He was there all the time. They were impressive. And most of them were in awe of the ball players too. That was amazing. We were in awe of them, and they couldn't wait to talk to baseball players. They thought that was great. Autry was the biggest fan of all time. I mean, he was he was a baseball fanatic. And so a lot of us went there. Vern Stevens, who was an outstanding player, Bob Lemon, we played golf there. We had great times there. And so it got to be kind of usual to meet these guys and find out they, off the screen, they're, you know, they, it's the old saying, they put their pants on one leg at a time. And so it was really an education to meet these guys, and finally got to be, wasn't so impressive. It was just kind of routine. And we found out Lou Costello, he was one, he was a tremendous baseball fan. And Bud Abbott, and I got to know all those guys. And of course, I got to know them in Palm Springs a lot, because even Howard Hughes, who was one of the most mysterious men of all time, I got to know him. I didn't know him well, but I got to meet him. I could say that better. And Spencer Tracy. And of course, the Rocket Club in Palm Springs, they had Charlie Farrell, who was an old-time, when they didn't speak in the movies, they had to use subtitles. Got to know him personally. William Powell was a tremendous friend of mine, one of the great actors of all time. And I got to know him very well. And so it was a, I had a pretty good life. I mean, I have a better life than these guys today. So I can't complain. I didn't make as much money, but I wouldn't trade it for all the things they have.
That's, really, how did you end up in Palm Springs? And then on into their salad days.
We could talk about how I got into broadcasting.
Okay.
So why don't we wrap up your major league career? You were in traded to the Indians in 1955, once again reunited in a way with your old friend Hank.
Well, again, we mentioned earlier that Hank Greenberg was very instrumental in my life, and then once again he became very instrumental when he was going to get the franchise with Bill Veeck for the expansion of the American League into the 10-team league, mm-hmm. in 1961. I was broadcasting, I was the GM of the San Diego Padres for 5 years, and so I resigned my job as a GM, and I was going to be a part owner, minority owner of the newly founded franchise in California, which Veeck and Greenberg were going to be the principal owners. And they said, we'd like you to come with us, and we could probably use you to run the farm system and be a part of our operation. So I resigned my job, and they came out there to set up the dates for playing baseball in L.A. with the Dodgers, who had moved out there in 1958. This is 1960, the fall of 1960. And maybe into the spring of 1961. And so I was with Hank when he went to the Coliseum Commission and got the dates to play, holding the dates to play in the Coliseum, mm-hmm. along with the Dodgers. The Dodgers were building their stadium. And then all of a sudden, the picture changed, and O'Malley, who owned the club, the Dodgers, called Ford Frick and had Frick come out, who was the commissioner of baseball. And Frick came out, and they changed the grounds rules to some degree. One, you had to pay some damages to the Dodgers for coming, the American League coming into the area. Mm-hmm. And two, you had to play your games when the Dodger, new Dodger Stadium was set up in Dodger Stadium. The ballpark they were going to play in was Angel, the Angel Stadium. And the Dodgers said, you got to be second tenants in our ballpark, which Hank didn't like. And it's almost impossible to be a second tenant in the same ballpark, because mm-hmm. you're really second place and everything mm-hmm. is done because you have to do what they want to do. And so Hank pulled out of the deal. And at the time, Hank had already negotiated the rights for the baseball broadcast on radio and the money for the broadcast. And he was negotiating with a fellow named Reynolds, who had been a 60-minute, three-time tackle for the Stanford Indians that played in the Rose Bowl and the Vow Boys in 1933, 4, and 5, I think, for the years. And Reynolds was the big man, second to Autry with that radio station and network of radio stations they have. And Autry was always instrumental in baseball and wanted to have a team. So when Greenberg and Beck pulled out of the deal, Autry had already acquired the rights of the game, and that's how he got the California Angels. Mm-hmm. And also standing in the background was a guy named Fred Haney. And Haney got the job, I believe, as manager out of that whole deal. Mm-hmm. He was looking for a job with the Mets, and with Greenberg. He was looking for a job with Greenberg. And Greenberg was going to hire Casey Stengel to be the manager of the ball club if they had gone through with the deal. He had just been fired by the Yankees. Yankees. Mm-hmm. So that now I'm left without a job. I had resigned my other job. But I was offered the job in 1960 of broadcasting the Cincinnati Reds, to work with Frank McCormick, and also to have a job as doing sports in Pittsburgh on news, like 6 and 11 or whatever, or the White Sox job, which Beck and Greenberg still owned. And I took the White Sox job, and that was my first year as a broadcaster. That's how I got into broadcasting. Mm. And so I worked 1 year with the White Sox, and then the Mets started up, and I never knew who it was that recommended me to George Weiss, but I got a call from Weiss. I was broadcasting the Bing Crosby golf tournament at the time, and he said, would you be interested in working with the Mets? And I said, I certainly would, if I could get out of my job. I had re-signed with the White Sox to do their broadcast, if I could get out of the White Sox job. And he said, well, we have already picked Lindsey Nelson and Bob Murphy, and we would like to have you. Later on, I found out that John McHale recommended me to George Weiss, and that's how I got the job. I always had thought it was Hank Greenberg, but it wasn't. So anyway, I got the job with the Mets and got started with the Mets in 62. And I kind of joke about it, and someone said, well, how'd you get picked for the Mets job? I said, because I saw who I played with all my life, and I had a losing record. But it was really went through. But incidentally, the Mets in that the year in 1962 broke the record set by the Pirates of 112 losses.
Right.
They lost 120. Mm-hmm. So that was it. But it was again change of my life. Interestingly enough, never in my life have I ever applied for a job. I've always been given a job. And people had come to me, which I think is I never had to write a resume, which is really great.
Pretty cool. Now, history treats the Mets in a very lovable fashion, the lovable losers and all that. What was it like watching 120 losses.
Well, 120 losses were easy to take because it would be like watching a beauty contest and finishing last. The first nine were pretty, but it wasn't bad having number 10.
Okay.
But we didn't expect a whole lot, and none of the people did. And the one thing that made it, two things I think made it different. One, the people in New York were so happy to get National League Baseball back in the town, they would take anything, which they really got. And the other was Casey Stengel. Casey Stengel made it so easy to lose those games in a way that he always had something to say, would take the onus off of the losses. And nobody expected much, and they got nothing. But Stengel was the guy they got that made the difference. And he was such a wonderful guy to be around, and so zany that you had to have a good time being around him. And he was indefatigable because he never got tired. The guy was the last guy to go to bed and first guy up in the morning. So you always had Casey there.
What's your favorite?
And we had a good time. And then, fortunately, as a broadcaster, working with Lindsey Nelson was a delight, and Bob Murphy. So, and we were like brothers. I mean, we went everywhere together. We had dinner together. We went around together and had a great time, too. And it made, for 17 years, it was really a great relationship. And then Lindsey left, and of course, Bob is still there. And well, of course, we've become more, been there sort of 40 years, 41 years. Really a great association.
What's your favorite Casey Stengel story?
Well, my first story about Casey, and there were so many you couldn't tell them all, was my first broadcast with him. It wasn't called a Kiner's Corner, which I have done over the years, but it was just a post-game show. And we played our first game at the Polo Grounds, and I had to have Casey as my guest on the show. Now, I had never done baseball TV. And I had done radio with the White Sox, but not TV. And so I was apprehensive about how Casey would be. And as you know, Claire, being around Casey, he never stopped talking, so you never knew where the end was. And in television, you had to get off the air on a specific minute.
Right.
And so I'm doing this interview with Casey, and it's upstairs, inside, underneath the stands, way back in the catacombs of the Polo Grounds, a terrible place anyway, because they had to resurrect the Polo Grounds for the Mets.
Sure.
And I'm doing the thing, and everything's going pretty well. He was fabulous this way. He knew your job, and he would work with you. He knew what you were trying to get, and he would do this. Now, the next thing I'm worried about is getting off the air. And so he stopped at the right time. He knew that, too. And so I thank him. I say, Casey, it's really wonderful for you to be on my first show, and I wish you luck and whatever I said. And he says, thank you very much, and gets up and walks off. Well, unfortunately for me and the crew that worked the show, he still got the lavalier on around his neck with the audio, and he tears the whole set down, all collapsed. And now my AD is standing there. He's petrified. Because he's got to get it back up, and he has to get off the air. And finally, I said something. I really don't remember what I said. Well, we'll be back in just a minute after this commercial or whatever. So anyway, it's a minute or 2 minutes, and we're back. And I said goodbye, and that was my first show with Casey. But he was an amazing man, and I think everyone, a lot of people thought he was a clown, but I've been with him when he could talk as straight as anybody in the world. And he knew baseball as well as anybody knew, and he had all that great experience. And he was a character, there's no doubt about that. And then the other thing, when I was a kid growing up, I knew Casey Stengel because he was one of the scouts. He had been the manager of the Boston Braves. Mm-hmm. And he used to watch me play, and he tried to sign me for Boston. So I knew him from my high school days.
Wow, small world.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And you also had Yogi there as a manager who was a character, too.
Well, yeah, we had a lot. And, of course, I've been known for my, what is the word? I can't think of the word.
Malaprops.
Yeah, malaprops.
Yeah.
And My answer to that is if you work with Casey Stengel and Yogi Berra, you got to have a few problems coming up. But of course, Yogi, I've got to know him. One thing about the greatest thing that ever happened to me, of course, being a baseball player and being around and knowing all the great baseball players from the era of, say, 1930 on. I did get to meet Babe Ruth. I did get to meet Ty Cobb. I met Babe Ruth when he was filming part of the Yankees. He was played the part of Babe Ruth in that movie. Babe Herman was a fellow that got me there, a great player for the Brooklyn Dodgers. He was trying to sign me as a high school player, and he took me down and introduced me to Babe Ruth. Of course, Ruth didn't know who I was. That was the only time I met him. I met Ty Cobb at ball games at Hollywood Field, Gilmore Stadium. Met him several times. Got to know him a little bit. And I got, even that era of baseball, I got to know people. Met Connie Mack. And so I met all these people from a long way back in baseball. Mm-hmm. And it's been an exhilarating experience for me. I mean, it's just been a great life.
Ralph, could you spend a few moments on the summer and fall of 69?
Okay.
It has been a special time.
Well, 1968, we'd acquired Tom Seaver. And we also had Jerry Kuzma on the ball club, had Nolan Ryan in the background coming up. And in 68, the Mets finished ninth. But they had a lot of shutouts, which indicated they had a pretty good pitching staff. Mm-hmm. And when 69 started, of course, they were 100-1 in Vegas on the odds of winning the championship. But the people that make those odds didn't know we had Tom Seaver and Jerry Kuzman. And the interesting thing about Tom Seaver, the Mets never signed him. He was picked out of a hat. Mm-hmm. And Jerry Kuzman was going to be released by the Mets, but he owed the Mets $100 for buying a used car. And they kept him around to get the $100 before they released him. And they found out he could pitch, and then he stayed with the Mets, and we got the nucleus of two of the greatest pitchers that ever pitched. Mm-hmm. I don't think Kuzman ever got the acclaim he should have gotten. Right. And, of course, 69 started, and we got off to a pretty good start. And I remember the first time that we got to 500. And that doesn't sound like much, but they had a celebration when they got to 500. And our first year we lost our first nine, our second year our first eight, our third year our first seven, and our fourth year our first six, I think. And then we got rained out of our first three games in Cincinnati, and it was the best start we ever had. But anyway, in 69 we got off and got to 500, and Seaver said, made a statement, "What are you guys celebrating for? 500 is nothing." And he kind of chastised the ball club for being satisfied with the 500 percentage and the winning percentage. And then we kept playing better and better, and then everything started to work our way. We won games you could never win. And it had to be destiny somewhere. We won one game, one doubleheader against Pittsburgh, and won both games 1-0. Kuzman drove in one run in his game for the one run, and Cardwell drove in one run for his game. We won that game 1-0, 1-0, that doubleheader. I mean, and things happened you couldn't believe, and it got better and better. Now we're really not in contention. We're 13.5 games out on September 10th, I think it was. And then Seaver almost pitches a no-hitter. We won that series. We had the black cat thing that happened at Shea Stadium when the cat came out in front of the Cubs and looked at DeRocher and then ran out underneath the stands. I mean, it was like a fairy tale, the whole thing. And as it turned out, we won 100 games and won the championship. Now we have to play Atlanta. Atlanta had a great team, Hank Aaron and whatever, beat them badly. Now we have to play Baltimore, and Baltimore had won 109 games the year before, that year, and had a great team. I mean, really a great team. And we lose the first game, Seaver loses 2-1, I think the score was. And next thing you know, Kuzman almost pitches a no-hitter in the second game. We win that. And then all these black cat things were going on with the Mets again. Shoe polish on the Kalyan Jones thing. Mm-hmm. Things are happening. J.C. Martin gets hit by a ball running inside the the diamond instead of the lane. We won that decision. Earl Weaver was going crazy. And we won the championship and were the world champions. It was the most unbelievable year I've ever seen in my life. And I was very lucky. I broadcast the World Series on radio that year. And that was my only chance of being involved in a World Series, and got a very great vicarious thrill out of the whole thing.
That's great.
I was in New York during that time, and nobody could believe it.
Couldn't believe it.
Especially going then in the World Series against the Orioles, no one could believe, because that Oriole team was unbelievable. Frank Robinson, Brooks Robinson.
But they had a great team, great pitching. Jim Palmer, McNally. And we were destined to win, that's all. And it was and I'd turn to Lindsay or Bob and say, "What the hell is going on?"
Yeah, I mean, coming from 7 years of just losing and losing and losing, the turn it around that quickly was quite stunning.
And well, of course, Clint Denon had a lot to do with that turnaround. We got him, and
that was
really
a big trade.
They gave us a power hitter. That was a big one there.
What was Gil Hodges like that year?
Solik. They never changed. And the thing about Gil was, you did it his way, you didn't do it at all. And the one incident I remember was when Cleon Jones didn't run after ball that he booted in the outfield. And Gil comes out of the dugout, and we're upstairs broadcasting the game, and was, I guess somewhere in the conversation of the broadcast, I said, "Where's he going? Take the pitcher out of the game?" Walk right by the pitcher. I said, "Well, maybe there's something wrong with Harrelson. He's walking towards Bud." Walked right by Bud Harrelson, kept on walking slowly, all the way to the left field. I said, "Well, what's going to happen now? I mean, why is he talking to Cleon?" Next thing you know, he's got Cleon by the hand and he's bringing him into the dugout. He takes him out of the game for not running after the ball he booted. That was the way he was. And everyone said, "Well, what's wrong? Maybe there's something wrong with him, physically." He's out of the game, didn't play. And he's leading the leg and hitting at the time. And he ended up, I guess, at 340 or 335. But he was that very historic guy and said very little, but you better do it his way or you didn't play.
You saw during that time, both as a player and as a broadcaster, some amazing players, Willie Mays and Willie McCovey. And can you talk a little bit about some of those players that you saw?
Well, the one question they asked me, who was the greatest player you ever saw? And, of course, I didn't see Gobble or Babe Ruth or any of those guys, the great ones of the past. But it's an impossible answer. And I might have changed my mind one or two times as to who I thought was the greatest player. And I think I would say, not having seen Ruth, the best hitter I ever saw was Ted Williams. It could be wrong. I mean, no one talks about Sam Musial. I mean, there's no question about Sam Musial being as close to him or ahead of him or what. Sam Musial was a fantastic hitter. Maybe the best all-around player. Boy, I get in all kinds of arguments on this, especially with my broadcast partner, Fran Healy. He says Mays. I say DiMaggio. And now I'm in trouble because it's almost impossible not to pick Mays. And my answer is that the one thing that DiMaggio did better than anybody that ever lived that could hit a ball hard, home run type hitter, was not strike out. He put the ball in play. In 1941, he struck out 13 times in the entire season. Now, all the other, he hit that 56 game winning streak.
Right.
He was putting that ball in play all the time. And when that ball's in play, there's something that's going to happen. And that's why I would take DiMaggio. As talent-wise, I think Mays is the best I ever saw. But if I had to pick, and to be, first of all, you'd be lucky to have a pick of DiMaggio Mays. I mean, either one, you can't go wrong. But I think I'd pick DiMaggio. I don't know. Tough to say. And of course, you got Hank Aaron. I mean, we'd leave him up. Why? I don't know. And there's a guy, you know, had all those home runs and was a great hitter for years and years and years. I mean, he fantastic player.
And RBI yeah. leader, right?
Yeah. And say, but Sid, he did everything amazing. Mm-hmm. And he was also a great fielder. Not quite as spectacular as Willie, because Willie's hat came off. It came off by design, I think. And he wore too big a hat. He wanted to have it. So that was, you know, it's hard mm-hmm. to boil it down. And I'm sure you leave out Frank Robinson. My goodness, what a player he was. Mm-hmm. I mean, he his numbers are amazing. And you don't hear much about him. And the one player, I didn't really see him play. I saw him play at the very end of his career that nobody talks about, Jimmy Fox. Mm-hmm. Mm. Boy, I mean, his numbers are unreal. He had 58 own runs in 1 year. Mm-hmm. And his RBIs were fantastic. And the guy could do everything. He could catch, he could play third, he could play the outfield. He even pitched. Right. You never hear his name mentioned.
Well, talking about records, we spoke with Tom a little while ago about the recent news about the steroids and what's going on in baseball today and how that affects the records. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know. I don't know that much about steroids. I've been asked whether I would use them if they were around when I played. And my answer was pretty glib. And I said, anything to hit better. But when you start to figure out if it's really true that it's going to be detrimental to your health later on in your life, shorten mm-hmm. your living career and that, I wouldn't touch them with a 10-foot pole. The one thing I think, and we were told never lift weights, although I did lift weights for a short period of time, but we were told don't ever build your muscles up because they're going to be slow and you can't hit. Well, that's been proven wrong by far by McGuire. Mm-hmm. And some of the other, of course, by a lot of people, but it's hard to say. If they are as bad as they claim to be, and I don't know anything about it, and they're banned by football and baseball and track and all the other sports,